Hi, good evening, and welcome to tonight's webinar for the American Herbalist Guild. We have a great presenter tonight, Lisa Ganora, and she's going to talk to us about plant chemistry and how color relates to it and antioxidants. So we're really looking forward to hearing from you. Take it away and share your expertise with us.
All right. Thanks, Stephen. So hi, everybody. I'm glad you're all here. Hello again to whoever I've already met, and hello to new people. So I'm here in Colorado with a foot of snow on the ground. We're eagerly awaiting spring and the return of the plants. So I am currently the new director of the Colorado School of Clinical Herbalism, which used to be NAIMH, or North American Institute of Medical Herbalism, that was started here by Paul Bergner. So there's a little plug for my school right up front, and our website is clinicalherbalism.com if you're interested in checking that out. So tonight we're going to talk about the colors of vitality, and I was just thinking how wonderful it is that I had created this presentation before I got into the school and into the vitalist herbalism. And it's really interesting that I was thinking in those terms, and now it's sort of my herbal world, vitalism. But I chose that title for this presentation, The Colors of Vitality, because it's one of those connections that it's easy for us to make between our instincts and our senses and phytochemistry, because a lot of times phytochemistry is this very abstract concept to a lot of us, and it's kind of gnarly and difficult, and it has to do with math, and we might not see the significance of it, as herbalists and as nutritionists. So I want to start out showing people how you actually can see, the vitality of a food or a plant or an herb. And part of the way that you can see that vitality and the living energy and the nutritious and the healing phytochemicals in that food or that herb is by the color that you see, because the color is really an interaction with various molecules in that plant, an interaction that those molecules are having with light, and we can see it. So it's sort of a sensory relationship that we can have with molecules, and we can start learning and understanding what those colors are telling us and what they mean about the medicinal properties of those molecules and how we can use them, as healing and therapeutic substances. And many of the powerful antioxidants that we like to talk about in medicinal foods and herbs are very colorful. So that ties, a bunch of those different ways of looking at things together. Another thing I wanted to say to start off with is, to me, and especially as I've moved through the brilliant curriculum that Paul developed for this school, there's less and less of a separation between nutrition and herbalism. And when I started learning herbalism, they were really separate fields, and I think a lot of you have the experience these days of they're really coming a lot more together and being more integrated. So now I just look at it as plants. food is a plant, an herb is a plant, and how do I interact with the different medicines that these plants create as the master pharmacists that they are. So with that in mind, let's look at how also one of the big things I like to do is bring together traditional wisdom, traditional herbalism, Western herbalism, and not just herbalism, but, traditional kind of nature cure wisdom, I guess you could say, with contemporary science. I'm always integrating those two in my practice, in my understanding, and in my teaching. So one thing that, back when I was early on learning this stuff back in the 80s, that I heard from a number of traditional herbalists and midwives, traditional healers of different kinds, was that the kind of saying that boils down all this, what should I eat, what should I eat, what should I eat, is to eat the colors of the rainbow every day. And that's become a popular concept now. There's books out about it and, the rainbow diet and all this stuff. But it's really interesting if you look at the blues and the reds and the different kinds of reds and the oranges and the purples and the greens and start making associations between those colors that you can see and the groups or the classes of phytochemicals that they represent, that starts making a lot of sense. So, you know, when it comes down to advising your client what to do, you know, if you can tell someone, if you have a purple food, a green food, a red food, and a yellow food, and an orange food every day, you know, you've kind of got your antioxidant thing covered. So we're going to look at the details of how that fits in with the actual groups of molecules, groups of antioxidants and anti-inflammatory and anti-cancer, et cetera, molecules that you find in plant material that does express these colors. So what we're going to do is take a tour through this in a sort of color spectrum organizational scheme, and we're going to look at green and talk about what do you see when you see green, what it does for you, and then we'll move on to yellow, et cetera. Okay, what we're doing here when we talk about the colors of molecules is one branch of organoleptics, and this word is becoming a lot more familiar. Probably a lot of you have heard about this already. Organoleptics is the art and science of using our senses in order to understand the phytochemical constituents in foods and herbs. And one of those senses, which we just talked about, includes seeing the colors, but it's definitely not limited to that. So you can look at these colorful fruits and vegetables, and you can look not only just at the colors, but at the vibrancy, at the intensity and the vitality of the colors, and that gives you an idea about the quality of the material. So this is something that we're all used to practicing as herbalists, is, you know, judging the quality of our herbal material by crushing it and smelling it and tasting it and, you know, really becoming familiar with it on a sensory basis. So we don't just look at the colors, but we also look at the characteristic aromas and flavors that will tell us something about the phytochemicals, the specific phytochemicals that are in plants, and also about the concentrations of those phytochemicals that are in the plants, and also about the activity state of those phytochemicals. So, you know, we know when something smells off or something smells weak or something smells burnt or overcooked or, you know, it has some weird chemical tang to the smell of it. That's something we're very good at detecting. So when we learn to do this, we give ourselves a sort of quality control ability, you might say, that's actually, when you consider the sensitivity of our senses, it along with some training, it definitely rivals what we can do, you know, to some extent anyway, with analytical equipment. And it's something that we all possess. It's, you know, part of our mammalian skill set, so to speak. And something that we can definitely develop with use. So we mentioned the sight, the aroma, the flavor, and we also know that the textures can tell us a lot about the constituents inside plant materials. Like, everyone here probably knows what astringency feels like, and the difference between a very mild astringent and a very powerful astringent is something we can taste. Or you might have had, you know, an experience of like making an eye wash out of hydrastis, and you thought it was dilute enough, and you tried a little bit in your eye, and it was like, oh, that's way too astringent, you know. So we can, with our mucous membranes, with a sensitivity, we can judge degree of astringency. Or, on the other hand, something like the degree of mucilaginous quality of a plant is easy to sort of feel by its gooey and slipperiness. So we are engaging all of our senses in this sort of instinctual relationship that we have with phytochemicals. Something I wanted to say about that is that, you know, the organoleptic skills are really something that's common to all life forms, like even going back to bacteria and the fact that they can detect what we would call scent molecules. And, you know, some of those molecules they're attracted to and some of them they're repelled by, and we call that chemotaxis in that sense. And our white blood cells do the same thing, actually, some of them. So it's a very deep, ancient, basic ability and skill that we have as living beings, is to detect chemicals. Or you might think of something about like pheromones, you know. As human beings, we, on a conscious level, we don't even know we're detecting pheromones. But, you know, we can smell attractiveness, you know, from like, ooh, a potential partner or something. Or you know, we can even, you know, smell emotional states enough to respond to them, maybe not consciously to be able to evaluate that. So this is a really ancient skill that we have, what happens in modern life is it's very blunted, number one, by not practicing it, you know, due to cultural constraints, and number two, it's blunted by the omnipresence of artificial scents and very strong artificial scents, you know, laundry soap, artificial scents in perfume and hair wash, body care products, you know, air fresheners are one of the worst ones because they actually deaden your sense of smell. So we're surrounded by, you know, really latent, powerful artificial scents that is detrimental to our ability to, you know, refine our sensory organoleptics. So one of the things that I encourage people to do is get artificial scents out of your life entirely, remove them from your house, you know, and it will allow you to start re-engaging this organoleptic ability that you have. And so with that said, let's go forward and start looking at some of these things and showing some examples. And I encourage you to, you know, take this webinar and go practice what we're talking about now. So here's an example of a really obvious visual one. Lycopene's a really famous phytochemical now. It's a type of carotenoid. In fact, it's the precursor, the parent compound of all of the other carotenoids. But some plants accumulate lycopene as they ripen, as they develop. Others take that lycopene and they turn it into other carotenoids, so they don't accumulate it. Lycopene is a dark orangey red color. So the more lycopene that say a tomato develops, the darker and darker red it becomes, right? So in this case, if you think back to the molecule, this is a model of it, you can actually see the development and the buildup of the concentration of that phytochemical when you watch a tomato ripen. All right, because we know tomatoes start out green, and like most of them, except for some special varieties, get darker and darker red as they ripen, especially if you look at something like a grape tomato or a cherry tomato, but especially a grape tomato really accumulates high concentrations of lycopene and other antioxidants, and so you can see that. And this is a really instinctual thing, too. You know, you go and you look at those tomatoes in the store and you're sorting through them, and then you see this really luscious, vibrant, you know, saturated, dark, orangey red color, and you're like, ooh, I want that one. You know, so we just have this instinctual attraction to colors like that in our foods. That's a really beautiful picture, isn't it? Look at that. They used to call tomatoes love apples. You see the little heart shapes in there. It's a very interesting structure inside the tomato. And it's not just tomatoes that accumulate lycopene. Lycopene is found in a few other plants, but tomatoes really feature them, and they're the most famous ones. So that's an example of a phytochemical that you can actually see, and you can watch the concentration build up. So just a really brief trip through where these phytochemicals come from. Plants make these, right? So a lot of times people start talking about phytochemistry, and they're like, ooh, chemistry, and they think about, like, guys in white coats or gals in white coats and, you know, nasty solvents and high-tech laboratories and all that stuff. But we have to keep returning our awareness to the fact that, you know, through their absolute brilliance, plants take the power of sunshine and they take in carbon dioxide, which we exhale, right? And they take in some water and they put out oxygen, which we need to breathe, and they the process of photosynthesis creates glucose. So, you know, this is something we tend to overlook because it's incredibly common and familiar, but if you just stop and think about it for one moment, this is one of the things on Earth that repeatedly blows my mind, so to speak. So we get glucose, basically. So glucose is a product of photosynthesis, and it's the ancestor molecule of all of the other phytochemicals, right? So glucose in one way or another, you know, gets changed and transformed by enzymes, various biosynthetic pathways, and becomes everything else. So if you're into ancestors in the molecular world, this is the ultimate ancestor of all the other phytochemicals. It's also what's running my brain right now so that I can talk to you over this high-tech teaching situation here. So this is human blood sugar, right? And it's pretty interesting if you look at the profound relationship right there expressed between plants and humans. You know, plants are taking the sun, they're making glucose, and, you know, by various ways we ingest that glucose, and it powers our brains and the rest of our cells as well. So phytochemicals come from the power of the sun, making the ancestral molecule. Nitrogen is taken out of the atmosphere by nitrogen-fixing bacteria on certain ones of our leguminous plants and a few others. And plants take minerals up from the soil and add those to some of their phytochemicals. So this is sort of the origin diagram here of where all these goodies are coming from, which, you know, is a really good reminder of what's fundamental for the health and life of plants as well as the health and life of humans. All right, here is a brief cartoon explaining antioxidants and how they work, because the rest of the molecules we're going to be talking about are antioxidants, and we hear this antioxidants a lot, and it almost seems like kind of counterintuitive terminology because, you know, oxygen is good for us, with this antioxidants, but of course we're talking about oxidation, right? So oxidation is a very damaging process for the most part. I mean, it has its place, definitely. It's part of, you know, the activity of some of the white blood cells in the immune system. Use oxidation, and some of the transformative enzymes in the liver use oxidation. So oxidation isn't all bad, but it definitely, if it's happening in the wrong place, it's very damaging. Oxidation in biological systems is mainly caused by free radicals. And we can be talking about reactive oxygen species, ROS, or other types of free radicals. And free radicals are highly reactive. They damage other molecules, including lipids and cell membranes, and they can also damage proteins and DNA. So they're something you don't want to have too many of running around, you know, on the loose in your body. So here's just a very simplistic but kind of fun way to look at that, is that a happy molecular atoms, a stable molecular atom, have in their outer regions, they have paired electrons. And electrons are funny little critters. We've never actually seen them. We know a lot about their behavior. We can deduce that in various scientific ways, but one thing about electrons that we do know is that they are very, very happy and stable to exist in pairs, right? So, and an unpaired electron, like this part of the illustration over here on the right, is very restless, and all that unpaired electron wants to do is find another electron as quickly as it can so that it can reestablish its stable state with being in part of a pair. So this is where the antioxidant comes in. An antioxidant is a special kind of molecule that's very stable because of certain features in its structure. And interestingly enough, those structural features, which you probably don't have time to go into too deeply, are also what give a lot of them their color. Okay, so the feature that makes an antioxidant capable of acting as an antioxidant often gives it a very rich color as a molecule as well. That's pretty interesting. As an aside, can tell you about the activity of that antioxidant, because people ask me things like, you know, my elderberry, I think I might have cooked it too long, and I ask them, well, what color is it? Is it still really, really purple, and that, you know, that gorgeous purple characteristic color of elderberry, or is it kind of brown? See, so when those purple antioxidant molecules in the elderberry lose their antioxidant power, they turn brown, right? So you can see the presence of the antioxidant power by the intensity of the color, which is really cool. So that's a way you can tell if your medicine is still good. Okay, so anyway, back to what's going on here. If you have an antioxidant molecule, what it can do is it can donate a loose electron to the free radical. It sort of has a sacrificial electron. So it donates that electron to the radical, and now the radical is chilled out, it's harmless, it's not going to go damage something, it doesn't have the overwhelming need to steal another electron from another molecule, which is damaging. Okay, so now over here we have on the left our antioxidant with, you know, one unpaired electron in its outer regions, but it's kind of stabilizing itself by distributing that electron. It's got the ability to sort of delocalize its electrons. But ultimately, it does have a little bit of radical character. Okay, so it needs to be repaired, so to speak. And who can come along and repair that antioxidant? This is a lesson about why we need multiple antioxidants. There are many, 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 many different antioxidant molecules in a natural plant material, especially in a richly colorful one, in, say, elderberry, since we're talking about them. So you never in nature find a single antioxidant. You just don't find that. What you find is multiple antioxidants that are capable of regenerating and reactivating one another. Okay, so what happens is a stronger antioxidant, and the strength again is determined by, you know, increasing stability of their structure. So the stronger antioxidant can come along and donate its electron to the former antioxidant, and now it's regenerated. In chemical terms, we say it's reduced, right? And this can go on and on and on and on and on. You know, there might be 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 different antioxidants in this cycle of regeneration. It's called a redox cycle or redox cycling. And this can go on and on until you get a super powerful antioxidant like this really mellow looking guy over here on the right. And it can exist for quite some time, molecularly speaking, with one electron. And then often what will happen is two of those will join up together and they'll share their two electrons. And that's the end of the whole sort of redox cycle with that. So we do need multiple antioxidants. They work much better together than an isolated antioxidant. Say, like, you know, something a lot of people will do is they'll be like, oh, I'm coming down with a cold, I think I'll take a bunch of vitamin C, you know, and they'll get isolated vitamin C, which is a great antioxidant, but in nature, it never ever occurs in isolation. It always occurs with its companion molecules, which are flavonoids, and flavonoids are also strong antioxidants. Or, you know, it'll have regenerative relationships with vitamin E as well, and there's that whole glutathione regeneration cycle. So vitamin C is like part of this multiple antioxidant, you know, protective, regenerative cycle where they work together. And that's why I'm really keen on, you know, if I think antioxidant supplementation is required, I'm really keen on, you know, using broad spectrum concentrated plant extracts and putting in them in the context of antioxidant foods or food concentrates or things like that. I'm not real keen on using isolated antioxidants. Okay, so that's kind of the background of some of the powers of a lot of these molecules we're talking about. So let's now go into our color scheme of looking at the different colors of these molecules and seeing what that tells us and what we can see. So we'll start out with green. As a sort of doing homage to chlorophyll, because chlorophyll, you know, without chlorophyll, I'm pretty sure we wouldn't be here. We certainly wouldn't be in the form that we're in. So chlorophyll is this really magical molecule. This is a picture of the central feature of chlorophyll that you're seeing. There's also some other stuff going on outside that makes it an oil-soluble molecule, but this is really where the action is in chlorophyll right here. And it's a really interesting and unusual structure, and you find this structure, by the way, inside hemoglobin, you find it inside some of the vitamins and some of the energy carrier molecules, and you find it in some of the phase one detox enzymes in the liver. So this little unit here is called a porphyrin ring. It's very special. It's really, the architecture of it is pretty gosh darn amazing when you let yourself look at that for a while. But what you see here is there are four nitrogen atoms represented by the N's there, and they have this special coordination bond. They call it a relationship with a metal ion. And in chlorophyll, that's magnesium. Okay, and that's actually what makes chlorophyll green. So when you take a special atom of magnesium, right, and you suspend it in that nitrogen cage inside that cathedral-like porphyrin ring structure there, you get the color green. Right? That's the wavelength of light that gives forth, which is a very intense, rich color. So in the background, we have nettles, beautiful, beautiful nettles, one of our favorite medicinal plants. And nettles are a very dark, leafy green, right? So quite a number of us have probably cooked and eaten nettles, or, you know, use dried nettles in our herbal formulas, or tinctured nettles, I mean, nettles vinegars. So, you know, when people say eat your dark leafy greens, you know, we think of the familiar things that we can buy in the grocery store, but I also like to promote nettles as a dark leafy green because it is an incredible source of chlorophyll. And it's also an excellent, anything that's rich in chlorophyll, of course, you're going to be getting an atom of magnesium in there too. And we know that magnesium deficiency is extremely common in our modern society, and magnesium is a really, really important nutrient to have for it's involved in so many different, you know, fundamental and important metabolic processes. So that's one of my favorite dark leafy greens there. So if you take this porphyrin ring structure and you replace the magnesium with an atom of iron, you now have one of the central features of the hemoglobin molecule, which fascinates me to no end, because old-timey herbalists and nutritionists will say chlorophyll and plants containing chlorophyll are blood builders, right? They build the blood. And when you look at this, you can see that that's pretty darn literal. You know, they're supplying these structures where you can just incorporate them into the hemoglobin. They're blood builders for other reasons as well. But that when you take iron and you put it in hemoglobin, you get the red color in your red blood cells, right? So that's pretty interesting. If you take the central ring system and replace that with an atom of cobalt, you've got vitamin B12. How about that? We all know that vitamin B12 is like critical for the function of the nervous system. People who don't eat animal products need to supplement with it. And it's important for energy metabolism and the mitochondria and all kinds of goodies. So it's just interesting to see how nature, in its wonderful, you know, using bits and pieces in a very efficient way, has taken this structure. And there's other things that happen with this as well. So just a few things about chlorophyll. In a beautiful moment, we're talking fast and doing some brain work here, to just relax and look at the beauty of chlorophyll. So this is a picture I took on one of our field trips, one of our high altitude field trips up to gorgeous place at 10,000 feet up here in the Colorado Rockies. And around about July, it looks like spring up there and just gushes with so many beautiful medicinal plants and all their gorgeous chlorophyll. And of course, there's our dark leafy greens that we buy and we eat, and these are also contain a lot of beneficial sulfur compounds, a lot of minerals, micronutrients, and all kinds of other things we'll be talking about. So, a few features about chlorophyll. Tradition, it's a detoxifier and it builds the blood, right? And if you think back of all the things we just said, you can see some sort of phytochemical justification for those statements, as well as clinical observation. So chlorophyll nourishes, it builds the qi, it's used as a deodorizer, which is really interesting. Some people would use chlorophyll drops. All right. As an isolated molecule, it's been studied quite extensively scientifically, and it has anti-carcinogenic properties. What we have here is chlorophyll inactivates heterocyclic amine mutagens, right? So these are the kind of things that you get in burnt biological material. So this is, you know, when you're roasting your delicious steak on your grill and you get that black stuff, or the fat drips down in there and burns and you get the smoke. This is what you get, the amine mutagens. It comes from, you know, burning amino acids, basically, or burning proteins. You also get it when you inhale any sort of smoke. If you're smoking any kind of plant material, you get a little bit of that, some worse than others. What about burning, you know, burning petroleum or burning plastic? So there's a lot of, we do get it quite a lot of exposure to these things in modern life. So it's nice to know that the more leafy greens you ingest, the more protection you have against that sort of thing. All right. We also know that chlorophyll helps to prevent the formation of DNA adducts, which is when molecules work their way into your DNA and actually insert them into that base pair sequence in there, the result of which is mutations. And sometimes those are able to be repaired, but sometimes they lead to the development of cancer. Okay, so whenever you see the rich green of chlorophyll in something, you can assume the presence of its companion molecules. So these are molecules that characteristically, if not universally, are found with chlorophyll in plants. And that includes folate or folic acid, right, which we know is really important for cancer prevention. It's cardioprotective, and it's pretty common knowledge now that pregnant mamas should take it to prevent neural tube defects in their developing babies. So folates are actually named after foliage, which is where the word comes from. So you can see where, you know, the association there with being found in your dark leafy greens along with your chlorophyll. And you can also assume the presence, let's see if I have another, there we go, of companion molecules that are always found in your dark leafy greens, and that's the carotenoids and the anthocyanins, or perhaps I should say flavonoids to be a little more inclusive there. So, you know, everyone's had the experience of looking at fall leaves on a tree, right? And you see green all summer, it's beautiful, and then when it's fall and the deciduous trees, suddenly you start seeing oranges and yellows and maybe even reds and purples. You're seeing the carotenoids and the flavonoids, including anthocyanins, that were sort of hiding under all that dark green chlorophyll before. So we're going to talk about those as groups too. So just assume whenever you have a dark leafy green, not only do you get the chlorophyll, the folate, you know, the magnesium, all those micronutrients, but you're getting carotenoids and anthocyanins as well. And that's because in all green plants, when chlorophyll gets, let me see here, when chlorophyll gets really excited in high intensity sunlight, it's a very vibratory molecule. And it, when the sun gets really strong, it's so excited that it starts throwing off a few loose electrons, which is like free radical generation. So all around the chlorophyll and the photosynthetic apparatus of a plant, you find a rich supply of carotenoids and flavonoids in there mopping up those free radicals and protecting, you know, the chloroplast from damage, from free radical damage, which is pretty cool. So the carotenoids and the flavonoids are acting as antioxidants to protect the chlorophyll and the plant and all its delicate metabolic processes. And they do the same thing for us. This is, you know, pretty another wonderful tie-in about how people and plants aren't that different. Okay, so that was green. There are actually very few green molecules in nature, which is interesting. Chlorophyll sort of has a monopoly on that, and I'm not complaining. It does a great job. So phytonutrients, yellow. So we're moving now into the yellow part of the spectrum, and there's several different interesting molecules that are yellow. So here we're looking at some yellowish-orange peppers, capsicum species, and they're expressing a beautiful collection of carotenoids. So let's look at a couple things about the terminology you might encounter when you read about these sorts of things. There are a few roots that mean yellow, okay, and one of them is xanth. So you might think of xanthine, xanthophyll, zeaxanthin. You'll see that word a lot. Or how about the Latin word for yellow root, xanthoryza? So it's pretty pretty common. All right. So here are two carotenoids, zeaxanthin and zeaxanthin. And you see these richly expressed in orange peppers. Orange peppers are one of the greatest, you know, most easily available dietary sources of these compounds. Viola is, you know, named after a plant genus, and zea is also, and that's corn. Okay, so pansies and violets, and those sorts of things, and corn is where those came from. A different kind of yellow that we see and that we use as a supplement sometimes, and we talk about, it's also very concentrated in some of our medicinal herbs, is quercetin, which is named after the oak tree for some odd reason, I don't yet know. And it's a type of flavonoid. So that flavonoid is very different from carotenoids. Carotenoids are an oil-soluble group of antioxidants, and flavonoids, some of them are water-soluble, some of them less so. They're just really a different phytochemical class. All right, and then another different, and yet again different kind of molecule that we find that's yellow is beta-xanthin. So beta is named after the genus of beets, right? Or beta, some people call it beta. So beta vulgaris is the common beet. And beta-xanthin is actually a kind of alkaloid. It's a very unusual molecule. And you find that concentrated in yellow beets or yellow chard or purslane or yellow prickly pear cactus flowers. We'll get to that. So there are a few different kinds of molecules that can be yellow. All right, so let's first look at our friend the dandelion flower and Viola zeanthin. It's very common in green leaves. You see it in yellow fall colors, highly concentrated in yellow peppers, and you find some in most of your yellow veggies, one degree or another. Dandelion flowers are an excellent source of Viola zeanthin. I really like to carry on about dandelion flowers because they're abundant. They're one of those weeds. We can use them a lot and not worry about, you know, ecological impact. They're also free. They're seasonal, but, you know, eating dandelion flowers is actually one of the cheapest and most powerful ways to get a high concentration of these very beneficial phytochemicals into our systems. So they taste a lot better than most people think they'll taste, just with the one caveat that people that are highly allergic to Asteraceae family plants, to the sesquiterpene lactones in the Asteraceae family plants, which includes ragweed, can have a reaction to dandelion flowers. I've only seen it happen once where somebody got itchy and sneezy after they ate them, and it was uncomfortable but not life-threatening. But, you know, just keep that in mind. If somebody tends to be really highly allergic to Asteraceae, you might not want to encourage them to eat dandelion flowers. Okay? So Viola zeanthin, and you see that yellow in the word there, zeanthin, is a special kind of carotenoid, and it's called a xanthophyll, which means yellow leaf. Right? Phyll is the root word that means leaf. So again, you see it in fall colors, right? So xanthophylls are the oxygenated carotenoids. They're excellent antioxidants. Oops, I just said that. And they're oil soluble or fat soluble. So that's kind of an important point. We need antioxidants in our bodies with different solubilities because they're attracted to different types of tissues, right? So an oil soluble antioxidant, like the carotenoids, like the Viola zeanthin that you actually see when you look at the dandelion flowers there, tends to accumulate in the adipose tissue, right, and in the fat cells. And it has, and also it accumulates in cell membranes. So these things actually get into our cell membranes, and they you know, float around, and they're acting as antioxidants, and they protect the cell membranes from lipid peroxidation, which is, you know, one of the fundamental processes, one of the fundamental metabolic processes on a cellular level that can start a lot of disease states. So it's really important to have these fat-soluble antioxidants. Okay. Another thing that they've discovered, at least in vitro, is that Viola zeanthin is a really strong inhibitor of Epstein-Barr virus activation, which is behind the development of certain types of cancers. So it kind of keeps that Epstein-Barr in a dormant state, which is really, really interesting. All right, so here is a model of the Viola zeanthin molecule, and excuse me, you can see this very characteristic sort of zigzag architecture that you get with the carotenoids. All of them have this; they inherit that from their ancestor lycopene. Okay, and the carotenoids might be a little different out here, and there's a little different out there, so there's some variations on the theme, but they all have that long zigzag structure, which allows their electrons to delocalize, which gives the, because that's, I'm getting into a lot of detail here, but very quickly, this is what's called the chromophore of the molecule, so it's the colorful part, and it's also a conjugated series of double bonds, which means double, single, double, single, double, single, double, single, over and over again, and that allows the electrons in that molecule to delocalize, to spread out, and it gives it extra stability so that it can donate, you know, one of its electrons, usually it comes off right there, to quench a free radical. So you see that structure in all of the carotenoids. It's really quite fascinating. And there's our little friend, the honeybee. Support your local honeybee. Okay, here's another one, zeaxanthin. So there's some pretty yellow corn in the background there. It's named after corn, but you find it in a lot of other things. So again, corn and xanth is yellow. The richest source of zeaxanthin is orange peppers. All right, and it's also plentiful in your dark lean greefies. Your dark lean greefies, that was a good one. Your dark green leafies, including the store-bought ones and your wild greens and nettles. Okay. What's really interesting here is zeaxanthin accumulates in the retina of the eye, and it protects our visual pigment from UV radiation. Now, what's going on with that? Let me see if I actually have a – I forget if it's in this show or not. Hold on with these two. We'll get back to that. Dot, dot, dot. Sorry about this. Yep. Let's look ahead to this, because I was going to talk about this under lutein, but it's fun to talk about it with zeaxanthin as well. So if you look at this diagram of the human eye, you see the highest concentration of light comes in through here and does that nifty little optical flip, and then it lands on the retina in this certain spot, and that spot in the retina is actually deeply yellow. That spot, if you look up here, is called the macula lutea. Macula is spot, lutea or lutea is yellow, right? So it's another root word that means yellow. And it is yellow because if you look down here, it's rich in lutein and zeaxanthin, right? So the wisdom of nature and the wisdom of our bodies, you know, collects this lutein and this zeaxanthin from our foods and our herbs and our wild foods, and it deposits it right there in the macula lutea. So you have this huge concentration of antioxidants right there. And what they're doing is they're catching the free radicals that are generated by the ultraviolet light that's falling on that yellow spot, you know, in that high concentration yellow spot. So that's nature's way, you know, of protecting your retina from damage. When this gets damaged, what you have is a condition called macular degeneration, right? So macular degeneration is a very common cause of degenerative blindness in our culture. And some of that is due to high free radical load in the body. Some of it is due to deficiency of the carotenoids of lutein and zeaxanthin, right? So they're very protective against this. Studies show that they can halt the progression, and there is some evidence that in some cases they can actually have, you know, maybe not an entire healing effect or reversal effect, but that is possible to some degree. So let's just skip back to where we were with the zeaxanthin right there, okay? What else does zeaxanthin do? It helps protect the skin from ultraviolet damage, just like it helps protect the eyeball from ultraviolet damage. So when you accumulate these, you know, in the fat cells in your skin, in your subcutaneous fat, when you have a high accumulation of carotenoids there, it has a protective effect against the development of skin cancer. So that's why I call these nature's sunscreen. I had always suspected this based on, you know, the physiology and the biochemistry of it, and then I finally found a few studies that indicated that this is actually does happen. So that's pretty cool. It's very protecting and strengthening of cell membranes as well, and as well as having an antioxidant power there. So it helps adjust that all-important cell membrane integrity, cell membrane fluidity, and helps protect against lipid peroxidation in your cell membranes. So we'll jump forward now to lutein. Lutein is a really famous carotenoid, and you may have heard of luteolin. That's a flavonoid. Okay, so luteolin, you know, is also found in dandelions, which is all kinds of fun. But right here we're talking about lutein itself, and again, lute means yellow. So when you look at this beautiful picture of the Tagetes species marigolds here, this is actually where they farm lutein, so to speak, because these are so rich in this phytochemical that they're an excellent source for making supplemental lutein, right? So it's a very potent antioxidant. It helps prevent ultraviolet damage and macular degeneration to protect the retina. We talked about that already. Richest dietary sources of lutein include, and those of you in the Appalachians will know what I'm talking about when I say creasy greens. It's a very popular traditional early spring wild food. It's a Brassicaceae family wild green. If you look it up in a lot of the guidebooks, they call it winter cress. So that's your creasy greens. Parsley is a great edible green that's also a medicinal plant, very rich in lutein, and then your usual dark leafy green vegetables. And, of course, it's also found in your nettles and other similar, you know, edible greens. And in dandelion greens and in dandelion flowers, you also find some. So that was is xanthophyll. Lutein is a type of xanthophyll, which is a type of carotenoid, which is an oil-soluble, highly protective antioxidant. They also are cell growth regulators as carotenoids, so they help, you know, to promote the healthy growth and division of cells and to discourage the growth and division of cancer cells in many different kinds of tissues in the body as well. All right, so now we'll switch to the other kind of yellow, or one of the other kinds of yellow, which is quercetin, which is a really potent flavonoid. So we see quercetin expressed in various different foods. Like you see a lot of it down here in the onion skin, in the yellow onions. And I have had people say, well, that's nice, but it, you know, it's really concentrated in the onion skin. There's much more of it in there than there is in the interior of the onion, which is true, but there's also a significant amount in the interior of an onion as well. You just don't see quite that concentration. Also, you can decoct your onion skins and like sort of strain that out and add it to other things like your medicinal soups and stews and broths and those sorts of things. So you can get a lot of that quercetin value that way as well. You find quercetin, you know, expressed in things like some of the yellow citrus fruits, named after the oak we already mentioned, and citrus fruits. You also find a good dose of quercetin in your brassica vegetables, right? It's bright yellow. It's a flavonoid. And its companion molecule is always vitamin C, right? So in natural plant material, we'd never find quercetin by itself. We find it with numerous other antioxidants, including vitamin C, which is very wonderful for us. It has the anti-inflammatory and anti-cancer activities common to most of the flavonoids. Something special about quercetin is it's helpful for allergies. So we might say anti-allergenic might not be the exact proper term there. We might call it anti-allergic or, you know, help suppress overactive allergic reactions. And anti-inflammatory and anti-carcinogenic. So quercetin is what we, and also tonic for the cardiovascular system. So quercetin is what we talk about as a mast cell degranulation inhibitor. Let me see if I have that. No, I'll just talk about this for a minute. So we know that mast cells are involved in the, the allergic immediate hypersensitivity reaction, and a lot of our mucous membranes that, you know, are the sort of the first line of defense against allergenic, antigenic, irritating things like pollen, for instance, in the case of respiratory allergies. Those mast cells stay in there, and when they encounter their irritants, so to speak, they dump or they degranulate granules of histamine. And, you know, histamine is that immediate inflammatory signal that leads to swelling and, you know, itching and itchy eyes and red eyes and sneezing and sinuses being irritated and inflamed and all those sort of respiratory allergy symptoms that we get. So when you inhibit mast cell degranulation, you know, you cut down on the intensity of those reactions. I'm not going to go off about treating allergies. That's a huge, long subject, but just think of things that are rich in quercetin, and it's very interesting. It's a lot of the medicinal plants that we use for allergies are, you know, good sources of quercetin and other important active molecules as well. Okay, so let's move on to the other kind of yellow that we haven't talked about yet, the beta-xanthans or the beta-xanthans. So in the background here, we have a lovely picture of multicolored beets, including a nice golden yellow beet up here. You do find some of these beta-xanthans in your dark red beets as well. There's a minor concentration. You just can't see it because you're seeing the purple ones instead. But they are in there. And also when you have that wonderful, colorful Swiss chard, what they call that rainbow chard, where it has really like golden yellow stems, those ones there are really expressing this stuff to a high degree, so you get a good concentration. Okay, so if we look down here, beta-xanthans are unusual pigments. Pigment means a colored molecule, basically, with a limited distribution, which means they're only found in a few plants. They're not a common sort of molecule, so you sort of have to seek them out on purpose, right? Primary dietary source is yellow beets. They're also found in purslane. which is, you know, one of my favorite wild plants. You know, you kind of might get that idea by the fact that I put it on our logo and all our postcards and our banner and everything. I just love purslane. It's so vigorous and mighty and rich in beneficial phytochemicals, including these beta-xanthans. And you can see it there if you look at the purslane flower. You see that yellow color? Now, not all yellow flowers contain these. Like, few of them do, actually. But this is one of them where you actually see it right there in the flower. And you can kind of see it in the yellowish tinge of the leaves as well. That's kind of yellowish green. All right, so you see it there, and the interesting thing about these beta-xanthans is that they are extremely strong antioxidants, and by virtue of the same molecular powers, they're potent anti-carcinogenic compounds and anti-inflammatory. Those things always go together. Antioxidant activity, you know, anti-inflammatory activity and cancer prevention activity are all part of the same game with phytochemicals. So, you know, if we think back a minute ago to when we did our phytochemistry cartoon or our antioxidant cartoon back there, you saw that there's a cycle of antioxidants of different strength, and one will protect another, and you have, you know, 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 of them involved in that redox cycle where the stronger ones are regenerating the weaker ones. This is one of the strongest ones that we know of. Okay, so these can regenerate all of the other antioxidants. They have a, you know, better, you could say, a higher power of being able to regenerate, you know, any of the other antioxidants below them. So they're really strong, and lucky for us, they're also quite heat resistant, so you still get them in cooked foods. But how I like to take advantage and use these therapeutically is I like to throw a beet in the Vitamix. That's my strategy, and, you know, whip it up with a bunch of other vegetables and use that incredible vegetable pudding, and then I like to eat a lot of purslane when it's in season. Okay, and here's another fun source for those of us who live in the West, and actually these grow in many different parts of the country, and these are prickly pear cactus. So when you look at the beautiful prickly pear cactus flowers, and we're talking plants of the Opuntia genus here, and also the Cholla cactus flowers, the Cylindropuntia, express these same wonderful chemicals, wonderful beta-xanthan phytochemicals. So you see it in that yellow of those flowers, and those are really delicious. Those are highly edible, mucilaginous, cooling, soothing, and rich in beta-xanthans. And just for fun, we're moved over into herbal world and out of food world. We look at one more bright yellow compound, and that's berberine. So berberine is a sort of alkaloid with a lot of medicinal powers. And it's just interesting to see how this is expressed in different medicinal plants. So here in the inset, over here on the left, we have yellow root, which is an uncommon plant. As far as I know, it only grows in the Appalachians. I wouldn't swear to that in court, but that's the only place I've seen it. And it grows on the sides of creeks, or they call the little creeks there, they call them branches. So it grows, and it's a really, really cool looking plant. It has this long, naked stem, really tall. It can be like a foot or 2 feet tall, sometimes even taller, and it grows in the flood zone of the creek, right? So when the creek floods or when the branch floods, it just kind of sits there and waves around because its leaves aren't down dragging in the water. It's a really brilliant, you know, adaptation and strategy that's come up with for living like that. But if you peel the bark, you look at the inner bark of these Xanthorrhiza, you see that it's really rich in yellow berberine. You can see that, right? And here in the background, we have lovely golden seal, a very fine, you know, eastern woodland plant. And you can almost kind of see the yellow in that, too, but where you really see yellow, of course, is concentrated in the leaves, I mean in the roots, although golden seal leaves are great medicinal plant parts. In fact, the leaf and the root together work better than either one of them does alone, at least for its antimicrobial activity. And out here in the west, we have Oregon grape. So this is a beautiful species of Oregon grape here, one of the taller bush species. Mahonia, some people call it berberis. There's taxonomic argument about that. but you see the yellow berberine expressed in the flower there. And if you eat those Mahonia flowers, you really taste the bitterness of that berberine too, because berberine is a wonderful bitter phytochemical. Okay, so it's a potent medicinal alkaloid. It's, by the way, a water-soluble alkaloid too, which, you know, most alkaloids have fairly low solubility in water. It has antimicrobial and antiseptic properties, especially topically, so it makes it really good for topical application on mucous membranes. All right, anti-inflammatory, antispasmodic activity. This is a really talented phytochemical. It can do a lot of different things. It's sort of like the Renaissance phytochemical. We know it as an astringent. In high concentrations, it's hemostatic, stops bleeding. Formerly, you know, it was commonly used by physicians for uterine hemorrhage and postpartum bleeding. Very tonic to the mucous membranes, right? And that gentle astringency, as long as you don't make it too strong, is really helpful there. And a bitter digestive tonic. Some of us might have experience with using it as a liver tonic to sort of stimulate the production and release of bile and help with fat digestion and that sort of thing. And we might think of it a bit as a detoxification compound by sort of giving the liver a little stimulation there. So that bright yellow alkaloid. Oh, one more thing about that, by the way, before we skip out of there. You can judge the potency of your berberine-containing herbal material by the saturation of that yellow color and the intensity of that yellow color, right? So, you know, if you get some golden seal and you look at it and it's not very yellow, it's probably not that strong, right? So this is one of those visual organoleptic quality control evaluations you can do. So you really want your berberine-containing plant material to be saturated golden yellow, right? Okay, let's move on into orange. And there's those beautiful fall leaves showing us some of their carotenoids there. So the carotenes are a subclass of the carotenoids, and they are orange, right? There are different kinds of carotenes. Of course, the most familiar one that we hear about commonly is beta carotene, right? But you think with that beta, that's sort of a Greek sequential thing going on there. So we have alpha carotene, beta carotene, gamma carotene, and delta carotene, and in all their subforms or all their isomers as well. So there's not just beta carotene. There's its four close relatives. You know, it's like Uncle Alpha and Auntie Beta, and then you have all their kids, which are the carotene cousins. So there's always this related complex of carotenes that occur together in a plant. So again, we don't just take out that isolated beta carotene. We want it with all its companion molecules. We want it with its synergistic antioxidants so that they can protect and regenerate each other. Now, these things work better together than they do as isolated compounds. Okay? So alpha carotene itself has been scientifically studied, you know, for its properties. Rich sources of alpha carotene are carrots and pumpkins, lovely carrots and pumpkins. And you find a little bit of it in your other orange and yellow veggies, your orange squashes and things like that. It's antioxidant, as all of the carotenoids are. And they've done some interesting studies looking at the influence of this carotene on pulmonary function, right? So if a person has high alpha-carotene status, or they have a lot of this in their systems, that's associated with reduced rates of lung cancer. So the way I conceive of this is it's one of the carotenoids that accumulates in lung tissue and acts protectively to get rid of free radicals and minimize damage. Beta carotene, as I mentioned, is the really abundant one. So we find a lot of it in, you know, places where you would expect, the carrots, in apricots. Of course, the concentration is higher in dried things because there's less water. You find it a lot in the delicious peaches, your sweet potatoes, your orange squash, things like that. We know it's also an antioxidant, a cell growth regulator, and we call it pro-vitamin A because your vitamin A in your body is made from this, right? So sometimes people confuse, you know, carotenoids with vitamin A or carotenes with vitamin A. Vitamin A is an animal product, so that's what the animal physiology takes carotenoids and carotenes, and it can turn them into vitamin A. So when you eat, you know, beautiful golden organic eggs, you get some vitamin A, or when you eat animal products or meat, you get some vitamin A, but you're getting your carotenes and your carotenoids from plant material. Okay. So where else do you get your lovely beta carotene? Is in your dark leafy greens. Look down here, collards, kale, spinach, and those sorts of things, as well as in your yellow, orangey vegetables. So there we have our greens and a model of beta carotene. And again, you see that very characteristic zigzag antioxidant chromophore system of conjugated double bonds that gives it its ability to be stable and to donate a sacrificial electron to quench a free radical. Here's a beautiful source of carotenoids. How about nasturtium flowers? And some of you may have eaten nasturtium flowers. You know, this is a wonderful sort of visual gourmet feast way to get carotenoids into things. So if you build beautiful, colorful salads for people and throw a few of those gorgeous orange and red nasturtium flowers on there, you're really giving a nice medicinal dose of the carotenoids, along with the beneficial sulfur compounds in there. And we know sulfur in general is detoxifying and antimicrobial, so that's always a nice combination to get there. Here's an orange carotenoid, the cryptoxanthin. The reason I'm saying cryptoxanthins is because, again, there's never just one. There's like the related group of them, you know, and you can say that about all phytochemicals. There's never just the one form, you know. Nature isn't that boring. Nature loves variety. So there's like multiplicity in phytochemistry and in nature. You can see it in tiny. You can see it in the large. So cryptoxanthin is the type of carotenoids that you find in your citrus fruits, right? So you get tangerines, not that papaya is a citrus, but it's in there. And peaches and mangoes and your citrus and your oranges are really good sources of cryptoxanthin. You find lesser amounts in apples, apricots, corn, and some other things that you see there, including your red peppers, right? So it's a pretty widely distributed carotenoid, and like all its friends, it's an antioxidant. They've also studied pulmonary function and its association and different parameters of lung capacity and the efficiency with which you extract oxygen from how much air you breathe in and different things like that. Healthy lung functions measured by those sorts of parameters are associated with having a lot of cryptoxanthin in your body. Here's a totally different kind of orange, okay, in one of our favorite medicinal plants, turmeric. So we talk about curcumin, but again, it's not just curcumin. There are at least 30 different forms of curcumin and very closely related molecules, which collectively we will call the curcuminoids. Right? So the curcuminoids, lucky for us, are bright and intense orange molecules. Right? So down here we see them in the fresh curcumin, very well expressed in the fresh curcumin there. And then here we see that they're still quite active in the turmeric powder. Right. Oh, I didn't mean to say fresh curcumin. I meant to say fresh turmeric. And we see them, you know, very highly expressed also in the dried turmeric powder, which is really cool because what that tells you is that they're very stable molecules, right? They don't turn brown and oxidize quickly when it's powdered. And also what that tells you is when you're going after your turmeric, you want that really bright orange, intense, saturated orange color because it's showing you the concentration and the freshness, so to speak, of your curcuminoids, right? So here's a model of the curcumin molecule down here. It's a sort of an oddball molecule. There's not to my knowledge any other plant that makes curcuminoids. Ginger makes rather similar molecules with some of the same structure, the gingerols. And interestingly enough, some of the same physiological properties do find in both ginger and turmeric, although they have very different character. So we have our curcuminoids, the orange pigment. Remember, that's a colored molecule in turmeric. It's a powerful antioxidant. It's anti-mutagenic and helps prevent cancer, and that's been extensively studied in all different kinds of cancer cell lines, at different kinds of organs, in vitro, in vivo. So it's one of those, you know, a lot of people who maintain an anti-cancer lifestyle, so to speak, will make sure to include turmeric in that. It has antimicrobial activity, which is great if you're putting it in your food in a very warm tropical sort of climate. You know, a lot of our spices like garlic and black pepper and, you know, cayenne peppers and all of those things help keep food from going bad. So they're traditionally used in warm climates as antioxidant, antimicrobial type of activities. Speaking of which, antioxidant also means preservative, right? So antioxidant-rich or chemicals that have strong antioxidant power are preservatives for things, for foods. So anyway, we also know that curcuminoids and turmeric are very protective and very healing to the liver, right? So they're hepatoprotective. They also help to stimulate the liver detoxification processes. They're phase two inducers. And they are digestive bitters, which is really interesting. So they're very gentle, you know, bile stimulants, fat digestion stimulants. And they have strong anti-inflammatory activity. Interest has focused a lot on the anti-inflammatory activity of the curcuminoids and of turmeric lately. And it's one of those great things that you can concentrate it, like as in a carbon dioxide extract of the curcuminoids can be a really nice anti-inflammatory and sort of handy way of getting a highly concentrated dose of anti-inflammatory. Some people like to use these when they're transitioning off of NSAIDs for, you know, different kinds of arthritic pain or muscular pain or, you know, rheumatic pain. Or people are like, you know, I'm not doing well with these NSAIDs. I need to cut down or get off of them. And you could sort of do that counterbalancing thing with moving in with a concentrated turmeric. So they really have strong anti-inflammatory and, you know, anti-mutagenic and antioxidant powers all simultaneously, which gives them a lot of talent. Sometimes people do talk about it's difficult to absorb, you know, the curcuminoids are not that bioavailable, so the new trick is to put them in with a special compound that comes from black pepper essential oil, which is called piperine. Sometimes you'll find herbal products, you know, with bioperine in it, which basically is the same thing, that really enhances the bioavailability of this. So when I take my turmeric, I really like to use it myself. I use a concentrated CO2 extract of it. And I take it with an oily food like coconut oil. It's very classic with your curries and all that. I'll take it with coconut oil because it is an oil-soluble antioxidant, right? So when you take, you know, this is all about taking things in context, right? I'd like to take my concentrated supplements, my nutrients within a natural matrix in which you would find them, or with their natural companion molecules, their natural synergists. And I like to take them in dietary context. So I'll do stuff like I'll take my highly concentrated curcuminoids with some coconut oil or with my fish oil, and I'll try to take them with, you know, a nice a meal that contains some healthy beneficial fats, and then I'll take them with black pepper. I like to kind of add my own piperine with a little drop of black pepper essential oil into the stew pot. So it's a pretty neat way to enhance your body's ability to absorb the curcuminoids there. And then we have our final carotenoid. We moved into the sort of orange-red part of the color spectrum here. There's two different kinds of red. You'll see this coming up. There's the purpley red, and then there's the orange-red. So here we are with the orange-red carotenoids that are highly expressed in your beautiful red peppers, right? So we find these in both the sweet red peppers over here and in the hot red peppers over here. So whenever you see a red pepper, no matter sweet or hot, you're seeing a high concentration of capsanthin and capsorubin, right? So if you remember the genus of the peppers, it's the capsicum genus. So that's where this comes from, caps for capsicum, right? And the root word rubin means red, and anthin kind of refers to a flower part, so I'm not exactly sure how that fits in. But if you look for that caps, capsanthin and capsorubin. And again, they have that characteristic long zigzag structure that's shared by all of the carotenoids. And the nice thing about these dark red carotenoids is that they are strong antioxidants, and they are very stable compared to most of the other carotenoids and most of the other antioxidants. Stable meaning they tend to be powerful, they tend to not degrade with drying. So you think of those dried red peppers, like we were just down in New Mexico and in Sedona, and where they have those beautiful strings of red peppers that you can buy, and they're so red, and they stay so red for such a long time, you know. You can hang them, you know, in your house or your door, like the tradition goes, and they stay red for years, you know. That's a stable phytochemical right there. And so you can still see that red power. Eventually, they turn brown, and when that happens, they've lost their antioxidant ability. And you also see this, the heat stability of these molecules is really obvious, right? So you throw some of these red peppers in your spaghetti sauce or your stew or whatever you're cooking, and you can cook them for a long time, and they still retain that bright red color, right? You can roast them, and they're still bright red. So these red carotenoids, the capsanthin and the capsorubin, are very heat stable. They're very stable to the atmosphere, which is indicating that they're very powerful antioxidants. So I try to eat red peppers on a regular basis in order to, you know, keep a steady supply of these things going. Cooked, and I eat them raw, and I eat them cooked. So here you can see, here's a pepper maturing, and this is sort of analogous to the situation we saw with the tomato a little while ago, right? So here we have the pepper is yellow, and then it starts developing the capsanthin and the capsorubin. You can see that it's coming in, and, you know, yellow plus red makes orange, and then the more mature it gets, the more of this wonderful antioxidant power that it accumulates until it's dark red when it's entirely ripe. So that's kind of slow. So again, that's an example of, you know, your organoleptic ability to judge the presence of this compound. So capsanthin and capsorubin, and here we're actually seeing these are, how shall I put this easily, capsanthin and capsorubin are derivatives of veolazanthin. So veolazanthin is the precursor or the parent molecule of them. So you can actually, you're observing the transformation of veolazanthin, the yellow carotenoid here. As the peppers mature, more and more of the veolazanthin is transformed by, you know, enzymes into the dark red antioxidants. And I said they are especially strong and stable. So I'd just like to show this picture of sort of the wonderful flexibility and creativity of the capsicum genus. So these are all different kinds of peppers. This is these wonderful collections of peppers they sell at Pike Place Market in Seattle. And you can see the different phytochemicals. So these are different varieties of peppers, right? So this illustrates sort of the phytochemical variability you can get, you know, with closely related species within the same genus or even within the same species. The different varieties can make a different array of phytochemicals. And, you know, you wouldn't necessarily know that from reading, or it might be kind of, you know, it takes some time to research that and find that out. But you can actually just look at it and see, right? So if you're looking for some of those orange phytochemicals, you go for the orange peppers. If you're looking for the red ones, you go for the red peppers. And you see, you know, the yellow xanthophylls in here. Up here, you're seeing purple. We haven't gotten to purple yet, but you're actually seeing anthocyanins expressed in those peppers, which is really interesting. And here's some red ones up here. And here we see our friend chlorophyll and the green peppers and maybe some more of the paler yellow carotenoids up there. So variety, beauty is in variety. Yellow is veolazanthin, neoxanthin, and lutein. Okay. Orange, we have zeaxanthin and the carotenes. In red, we have capsanthin and capsorubin. In purple, we have the anthocyanins and our lovely green chlorophyll. So this is also an encouragement to seek out a wide variety of colorful vegetables, right? And like some of our heirloom varieties and our older varieties can have a really high concentration of nutrients and antioxidants as compared to some of the highly bred hybridized things that are easily available today. All right, a little bit more about lycopene. Lycopene, as we spoke of earlier, is red. You see that long zigzag carotenoid structure right there. It's concentrated in our tomato products, pink guavas, watermelons. You find it in pink grapefruit. You find it in apricots, higher concentration in dried. You also find a good concentration of lycopene in your wolf berries, which are also known as goji berries. We have a Native American species of those berries that grows down in the Sonoran Desert. So I go down there and I teach at the Naturopathic Medical School in Tempe every year. We just got back from that trip. And we always go out and look for the wolf berries, you know, and they're just incredibly delicious fresh off of the bushes. So for those of you in the area who don't know about those, or if you get the chance to visit down there, you know, keep your eye open for those wolf berries. They're ripe just this time of year. So we know that lycopene can help prevent cancers. It's especially associated with prevention of prostate, lung, and stomach cancers, although I think it has a very broad spectrum anti-cancer and anti-inflammatory effect.
Lisa, we're at the halfway point. You wanted me to interrupt for a break.
Thank you. So let's take our 3-minute break here and go do necessary things. And when we come back, we will start with the other kind of red, the anthocyanins.
All right. Go ahead.
Okay. So here we are back with the other kind of red. So we looked at the orangey red, which was the capsanthin and the capsarugin in your red peppers, and those were carotenoids. And remember, carotenoids are our oil-soluble antioxidant, anti-inflammatory molecules. Okay, so now we're going to skip categories, and we're going to move from the carotenoids into anthocyanins. So just to sort of give you some context here, anthocyanins are, sometimes they're called anthocyanidins, which is the aglycone form, and anthocyanins is the glycoside format of them, for those of you who are into that scale of things, which, by the way, is a good moment for me to just digress slightly and talk about glycosides, because a lot of people kind of get confused and think that glycosides are a category of medicinal molecule. Actually, they're a molecular format. So any of the molecules that we talk about, any of the types of molecules that we talk about, can exist in the format of being a glycoside or not. So if they don't have extra sugars stuck onto them, they're the aglycone, or the aglycone form or format of the molecule. And when you add another sugar or two or three or five, you know, bonded onto the molecule, then it becomes the glycoside format of that molecule. And we all know that sugar is water soluble, so the consequence of this is it increases the water solubility of a molecule when it's in its glycoside format. And even an oil-soluble molecule, like, you know, the carotenoids in some cases can exist in glycoside format, or steroids, for instance, can exist in glycoside format. Even like fatty acids sometimes can exist in the glycoside format. So it's not really a type or category of molecule. It's more like a molecular format that increases water solubility. So in a plant like these beautiful red cherries, or any plant really, or plant part, you can find a mixture often of glycoside and aglycone formats. So you'll find variable solubility as a consequence of that. So, you know, if you extract something with higher ethanol or you're making an oil out of it, you might get more of the aglycone of molecules. If you're extracting it with water or low percent alcohol, you'll get more of the glycoside format of that molecule out. So it's kind of nice because it gives you a broader spectrum of extraction, you know, abilities that the fact that these molecules can exist as glycosides or aglycones. Anyway, going back to the anthocyanins, which are a subtype of flavonoids, which are a subtype of the polyphenols. Okay, So we're in that world. So a lot of times people in general, you know, will talk about polyphenols or polyphenols and how, you know, how beneficial they are and stuff. You have to keep in mind there's thousands and thousands of different kinds, you know, like the tannins are polyphenols and, you know, the anthraquinone glycosides are a type of polyphenol. So there can be huge variation in character amongst the polyphenols. You know, some of them are quite toxic. Some of them are powerful healing molecules. So it's a broad class. So, you know, we have to be careful about making over generalizations, right? So when we're coming down narrower into the subcategories, down through the flavonoids, we get to the anthocyanins. Anthocyanins are really fun. Everybody has witnessed anthocyanins and their power to change color with pH, right? Because litmus paper is made with anthocyanins. Remember, you know, in grade school and high school, and you dip the litmus paper, and if it turns pink, it means you have an acidic solution, and if it turns blue, it means you have a basic solution, right? So it's really anthocyanins in that litmus paper that are changing color with pH. And you'll see this in your different fruits. For instance, you know, why are cherries red but blueberries are blue, right? These are different color expressions of the anthocyanins depending in part on the pH of the fruit and depending in part on the presence of different metal ions that they can complex with and other influences of other companion molecules. But it's really interesting, and you can demonstrate this to yourself with the famous purple cabbage experiment where, you know, you decoct a purple cabbage and you make solutions of different pHs and you squirt that cabbage fluid in it, you get this wonderful spectrum of colors, right? Everywhere from green and really highly basic fluids to like bright pink in your really acidic fluid. It's a really fun thing to do as a demo or do with kids. If you're interested in that, there's tons of videos on YouTube about it. You can dye Easter eggs in it. It's really kind of a cool demonstration. So the point of this is that your red, your purpley red fruits like red raspberries and your strawberries and your cherries and most of your really purplish red fruits, as well as your blue fruits like blueberries and bilberries and your almost purpley blackish fruits like your black raspberries and your blackberries and your black currants and, you know, your elderberries, they're all rich in anthocyanins. It's just that they're expressing the different colors, you know, in their different matrices and in their different environments. Okay, so they're flavonoids and they're present, and as I just said, in most of your dark red, purple, and blue fruits and berries, they're powerful antioxidants. They help filter UV light in the context of a plant, so they're also some of those free radical protection from sunlight that you get there. In general, anthocyanins have anti-inflammatory powers. And they're carcinostatic. Carcinostatic means helping prevent metastasis of cancers. Because we know, you know, cancer is not a great thing, but the really dangerous part of it is when it starts spreading to other tissues and organs, and that's called metastasis, right? So anthocyanins are carcinostatic, so they're a great anti-cancer food, both as cancer prevention and as dietary support when a person actually does have cancer. So here we see the lovely cranberry, which is also expressing a whole lot of anthocyanins, right? I really like cranberries. Cranberries go in and out of popularity, you know. First they're the latest greatest, and then it doesn't work so well, and then they're back in again, and first we think it's mannose, and now we know it's OPCs that, you know, help prevent the bacteria from adhering to the bladder, which is kind of interesting because I don't know if I have this in the show, but let me fit this in here. OPCs or oligomeric proanthocyanidins, which is the things we take in supplements as pycnogenol, you know, grapeseed extract, those sorts of things are rich in OPCs. Hawthorn berries and leaves and flowers are rich in OPCs, and cranberries are rich in OPCs, and very, very often you find OPCs as companion molecules of anthocyanins. So anthocyanins are highly colorful, OPCs are colorless, right? So they're sort of the quiet, hidden companion molecules of these anthocyanins. You also find them in elderberries, for instance. And OPCs are your small condensed tannins, so they have that gentle astringency and that antimicrobial, antiviral power, right? Hidden companion molecules. Okay, so cranberries, like all fruits, contain a complex mixture of anthocyanins. Some of the most prominent ones, so these are the names here of single molecules, cyanidin and pelargonidin, right? And cranberries are also rich in quercetin, which we talked about earlier. You just don't see it because it's kind of overwhelmed by all that purplish red. We used to, where I got started as an herbalist in 1986, was I was living out on Cape Cod, and there's beautiful national seashore out there, you know, out on the very end, out near Provincetown, and there's these quiet little hidden wild cranberry bogs out there. And that's where I first learned about the beauty of wild cranberries. So if anyone lives in that or visits that part of the world, if you get a chance, or different parts where there's actually wild cranberry bogs, it's really a very magical environment, and you can sort of experience the power of those cranberries there. And of course, if you're using like concentrated cranberry juice therapeutically, some people use it, you know, to help prevent UTIs, and you're also getting all of these anti-inflammatory and antioxidant and anti-cancer benefits from that. So I really like that concentrated cranberry juice. Please use organic, because they spray a lot of nasty chemicals on commercial cranberries, right? Our molecular model here is cyanidin, and this is a really common sort of architecture. You know, for people who know chemistry, this is pretty cool, and if you don't know chemistry, you can sort of look at this from an artistic perspective and think of it just as an architecture, as a shape, as a pattern. You know, you think of atoms having relationships, which are called chemical bonds, and you think this is like a pattern of atoms, or really atoms are mostly energy, so what you're looking at is a pattern of energies in relationship. That's how I like to define a molecule. So this architecture, or these patterns of energy, or you might say molecular structures, this sort of double ring shape here, in with this one poking off up in this direction, with a bunch of hydroxyl groups, you know, stuck on here and there and everywhere, that's very, very characteristic of the flavonoids. So you sort of see the different flavonoids are like variations on a theme of this basic pattern, right? And you can't really tell by looking at it. You might be able to tell if you look at like a line drawing, a chemical structure line drawing, like you see, like in my book, I go into this in a ton of detail, but there's actually, just like with the carotenoids that were long zigzag molecules, there's actually a conjugated series of double bonds in here. So you'll have a thing like double, single, double, single, double, single, double, single, double, single, double, single, and it's just wrapped up into rings instead of being in a long zigzag shape like we saw in the carotenoids. So you actually do have a long conjugated series of double bonds in here, which is the chromophore, the color bearer, right, which gives this a color, but since it's a different shape and, you know, a different length of chromophore, you get a different color coming out of it, right? And again, as I said earlier, that long conjugated series of double bonds, which gives it color, also gives it antioxidant power. It stabilizes, you know, an unpaired electron so that to act as an antioxidant, this molecule can donate an electron from off of here, maybe, or off of there, or off of here. And, you know, in real life, electrons ride on hydrogen nuclei, so it kind of, like, this is an OH group, and it donates its hydrogen, which is sort of the electron's horse, and it, you know, rides over there and takes care of that free radical. I'm getting old west here. It's like the cowboy, right? All right. Let's look for a moment at the blood orange. I really, really love blood oranges. They're one of the great, powerful antioxidant fruits. Like the red pepper, the sweet red pepper, or, you know, the hot red pepper is sort of, you know, one of the most mighty carotenoid antioxidant fruits, while the blood orange is one of the most mighty anthocyanin antioxidant fruits. Very interesting. It's the only variety of orange that contains anthocyanins, right? So most oranges are orange, or kind of yellowish, and the blood orange has that red purpley color. You know, it's just a little bit of a purple in there sometimes. And we know citrus is acidic, right? So you get your anthocyanins being really red in your citrus fruits, which is kind of cool. So not only do blood oranges have anthocyanins, which gives them extra super antioxidant power, but they have those carotenoids in there. They have vitamin C and its companions, the bioflavonoids, and the essential oil molecules in oranges and in orange peels, some of those are also really powerful antioxidants. Right, so many other bioflavonoids, vitamin C, lots and lots of goodies in there. So here's some other sources of red anthocyanins. You actually see it in the so-called red cabbage. I like to call that purple cabbage because it looks more purple to me. Excuse me for a second. And you see it in apple skins, right? Especially, you know, it's kind of funny because the red delicious apple is like one of the least delicious apples. You know, it's not that flavorful, but that dark red skin of that apple is extremely rich in anthocyanins compared to any of the other apple varieties. So, you know, if you're after your anthocyanins, you might want to, like, nibble all the peel off of a red delicious there and eat that. And then we have our cherries here, extremely dark red. You know, cherries can almost look black, you know, if you see a high concentration of anthocyanins can look black, right? And there we have our friend, except if you need to stay away from alcohol, but we have our friend over here, tincture of red grape skins, which we call wine. So that's you get some of the anthocyanin benefit as well as the famous molecule resveratrol in there. And down here we have a hawthorn berry, which is, you know, hawthorn, as I mentioned a few moments ago, is rich in OPCs and also anthocyanins. And over here we have purple onions, right, or the red onion, and you actually see the anthocyanins there in the onion. So not only are you getting your quercetin, a bunch of other flavonoids, and your beneficial sulfur compounds in there, but you're getting the beautiful anthocyanins as well. Something really interesting that I've noticed in the grocery store lately, in the natural grocery store, is they're coming out with, like, purple cauliflower, right, and purple varieties of, you know, vegetables that haven't previously appeared in the store in their purple form. So that's kind of cool because when you get that, you're getting that added anthocyanin benefit. Okay. My slides have stopped advancing. Let's see what we can do about that. There we go. All right, so we're still looking at anthocyanins, but now we're looking at them in the form of being blue, right? So here's our famous blueberries and bilberries, closely related, okay? And this is actually pretty interesting because if you look in the U.S. Pharmacopoeia, I think at least the last time I looked, I don't know if they've taken it out, but there was still one of those oddball herbal medicines, so to speak, or herbal extracts in there, and that was concentrated mixed anthocyanins, right? So this was previously used as a sort of phytopharmaceutical substance because it's very strongly venotonic as well as being anti-inflammatory and antioxidant and protective of night vision. So there's an interesting story. Tradition in the Royal Air Force in Britain during World War II, all the pilots were issued bilberry jam because people knew from experience that if you ate, you know, a concentrated anthocyanin source, well, they didn't talk about it that way back then, but if you ate a lot of bilberries, your night vision would be better. Right, so blueberries and bilberries are protective and enhancing of night vision and protective of the endothelium inside the blood vessels, which is really useful if you're dealing with therapeutics and prevention of things like varicose veins, or spider veins, or hemorrhoids, or, you know, blood vessel weaknesses that might lead to aneurysms and things like that. So very strengthening in that sense. Blueberries are great antioxidant fruits. So are many others. You know, blueberries are all famous. There's, you know, they have a great, you know, blueberry lobby is really powerful and, you know, they're relatively inexpensive. So what I like to do is go buy those, you know, go to those stores where you can buy bulk foods and buy, you know, big bags of organic blueberries. And I just throw them into a smoothie with coconut milk and other, you know, highly colorful fruits and like hemp seed powder, or chia seeds, and various healthy smoothie fillers, and you know, mix a little bit of citrus juice in there to sort of preserve the antioxidant power of the whole thing, and that's sort of my flavonoid burst drink. I get a lot of those in me. Cherries are great too. You can buy those big bags of organic frozen cherries. Okay, so antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, I mentioned, tonic for the blood vessels, and improves night vision. So those are your anthocyanins, your blue anthocyanins. And then when we're going a little higher in anthocyanin concentration, we get to our purple anthocyanins, right? So we find these most famously in the elderberries that we've talked about. So there's some beautiful picture of elderberries right there. And, you know, lately we're talking about elderberries as a sort of antiviral for cold viruses, influenza viruses, and things like that. And part of that activity is focused on different polyphenolic molecules in there, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if the anthocyanins were being sort of supportive, synergistic to that whole effect, right? You find these highly expressed in eggplant. There's your purple eggplant right there. You find them in your darker varieties of grapes. So, like, you know, you'll get some of these in your red grapes, but in your dark purple grapes is where you get a really high concentration of your purple anthocyanin. So what's that variety of grape? The muscadine grape, you know, that old strange grape that grows in grandma and grandpa's backyard, and it's got that really tough skin and it's all sour on the outside and slippery on the inside. Those grapes have a really, really high concentration of antioxidants, including OPCs and anthocyanins. Elderberries. We just mentioned black currants are a really good source of these. And you still get, you know, if you buy the dried fruits, like dried raisins or dried black currants, and you hold them up in good strong sunlight or look at them under a strong light, if they're still really purple instead of brown, then they still have their antioxidant power. Another place I haven't listed on this slide and really good source of anthocyanins and relatives are dried plums or prunes. They're very, very strong. And there's some interesting research that I think Tori Hudson introduced me to about a paper where they looked at the association between consumption of prunes and osteoporosis. And it was a rather strong effect that was found that eating like as little as, I think it was 5 or 6 or 6 or 7 prunes every day had a noticeable protective effect on bone structure and bone integrity. So that's another thing that anthocyanins are involved in, is protecting your bones and helping to prevent osteoporosis, right? So, and also here again, as I mentioned earlier, there are colorless companions of the anthocyanins, and those are the OPCs, right? The oligomeric proanthocyanidins that you find in stuff like grape seed extract, grape skin extract, all right? So here we're looking at a funny little trick of nature, the two kinds of purple, right? So we have our sort of reddish purple anthocyanins, and here we have betalains, okay? So earlier we talked about the yellow betaxanthins, right? And just to get the details right, betalains is like the larger general category. So there's a group of alkaloids found in very few plants called the betalains, and then the yellow betalains are the betaxanthins, and the purplish betalains are the betacyanins, right? Because cyan is a color word. It's not quite what you're looking at here, but that's we'll turn that color at certain pH. So betalains include yellow betaxanthins and purple betacyanins, right? So what we see here in the background of our photo is the purple cabbage leaf, right, in Brassicaceae family, containing anthocyanins, which down here, anthocyanins are a type of flavonoid, which is a type of phenolic, which is pretty much a synonym for polyphenol. So, you know, you can use those words interchangeably. So that's the most common kind of purple or red or reddish purple and blue that you find in nature. But betalains, or in this case right here, betacyanins, are really quite uncommon. As I said earlier, you need to seek these out. All right, so here's something that's very popular in the Southwest, the prickly pear cactus fruit, which they call tunas, right? And, you know, you can take those and make candy out of them and make jelly out of them and make pudding out of them, and you can cook them, and you can extract them and make syrup. You can do all kinds of cool stuff with those. You can tincture them if you want to. You can just cut open a prickly pear cactus fruit like we did here and just scoop them out with a spoon and eat them right up fresh. You just have to watch out for these things, right? These teensy, tiny little hair-like cactus vines that are incredibly irritating. So this is the other kind of purple that nature makes, right? So we have beta lanes, which include the beta xanthans, and I didn't write this up here, but also the beta cyanins. So the fun thing again, getting back to my favorite garden weed, purslane, unless my favorite garden weed is dandelion or maybe yellow dock or maybe chickweed. But if you look at this really happy, healthy example of the purslane right here, you see the stem is purple. Right, so earlier we were looking at the beta xanthans, we looked at the yellow flowers and the sort of yellowish cast of the green leaves, right? But we see the stem here is expressing the purple betalaeans, which are the beta cyanins. Very, very interesting. So you're getting both groups of betalaeans in the purslane very strongly expressed, and that's one reason that makes this such a healthy green. You know you can eat this fresh. It's tasty, crunchy, it's a little tart, slightly mucilaginous. You can also dry it. This is a trick I learned from an old French herbalist. They harvest this and they just dry it, and then they use it as a thickener in soups and stews, right, because it rehydrates and releases its mucilage. So, you know, instead of something like cornstarch or kuzu root or whatever, you can use dried purslane as a thickener, and you get a lot of the benefits of it that way too, since the betalaeans are very stable, right, so they maintain their powers through drying and through the cooking process. And down here we have the famous beet. I love beets with a passion. Beets are one of those vegetables that elicit strong reactions from people. Some people hate them. Often it's because they've only had weird tasting, you know, pickled beets in a jar at Thanksgiving from the grocery store, so they don't really express the deliciousness of a roasted beet. Roasting a beet is a great way to get the medicine out of it and the nutrients, because, you know, you can, like, cover them with coconut oil or olive oil and maybe chop up a bunch of parsley with that great stuff we talked about earlier in it and the flavonoids, and chop up a bunch of garlic and sort of toss your beets around in there and roast them. And roasting softens the cell walls and helps release these beneficial phytochemicals, and since they're so heat stable, it doesn't damage them either, right? So that's a great way to get betalaeans into your system. And I also, I think as I mentioned earlier, I'll just take like a small beet and I'll throw it into my Vitamix when I'm making my vegetable mush. Can't quite call it vegetable juice. You know, I like to keep all that gushy beneficial fiber in there, so I kind of make vegetable pudding in my Vitamix and drink that up. You can thin it out if you want to with like dilute lemon juice or dilute orange juice or things like that. Okay. So this is just another sort of art relief moment in our intensity here. Anthocyanins are responsible for many of the beautiful, beautiful flower colors that we see. So, you know, not that we necessarily eat these lovely flowers or use them for medicine, but I just wanted to sort of show that. And there you get this wonderful sort of lavender color being created by anthocyanins in Arminarda or our bee balm, which also, by the way, features thymol, an essential oil constituent that is strongly antiseptic and strongly concentrated in those flowers. Out here in Colorado, we have these lavender Minardas, but, you know, in different parts of the country, you've probably seen, you know, really scarlet ones or maybe even white ones, and various intermediate shades. It's kind of a variable plant. And, of course, Colorado is famous for our beautiful columbines. So here's a place up near Eldora. Maybe some of you have heard of Eldora. It's just a gorgeous, gorgeous area. And just, you know, along comes June, and you can get just covered with these beautiful wildflowers, including columbines in an aspen meadow. It's magical. All right, one more thing about colors. We have the color black. So in fruits and vegetables and flowers and herbs, the color black is actually very dark purple. right? So this is an extreme concentration of anthocyanins. You've probably seen this when you cook black turtle beans, you know, and you get that purple splashes on the countertop and stuff. And so this is black, unless it's burnt, you know, unless it's burnt material, is actually expressing a really high concentration of anthocyanins. So this is one thing that makes black beans or, you know, black turtle beans are a really healthy bean, is that dark, 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 dark purple in there. And here's another color, or perhaps lack thereof. Right, so we said the OPCs are colorless, right? I think this slide is a little bit out of sequence here, but we'll just turn our attention to that for a minute. So OPCs is oligomeric proanthocyanidins, which basically means the smaller of the groups. And so this group includes little ones and medium-sized ones and bigger ones, and the little ones, or the small polymers, are called the oligomeric proanthocyanidins. Okay, so OPCs, oligomeric proanthocyanidins, short chains of flavonols, such as catechin. Okay, so by chains, we mean short polymers. It means they're bonded together, and the catechin and the flavonols are a subtype of flavonoids. So if you take a few special flavonoids, string them together into, like, larger molecules that contain, like, two or three or four, maybe five-ish of these things, you have OPCs, right? So OPCs are sort of like giant, or not giant, but they're like collections, small collections of flavonoids, right? So they have the power of each flavonoid over and over again, right? So that's why they're such strong antioxidants, strong anti-cancer molecules, strong anti-inflammatory, strong antimicrobials, and gentle astringents, right? Catechin has been studied extensively. I mean, it's a pretty amazing molecule. You know, if you could patent a biomolecule, it would be patented and sold as a pharmaceutical for lots of purposes. All right, so the smaller of the OPCs are water-soluble, hot water especially. So these, you get these things out in, like, your teas, right, your infusions. And the larger ones are less and less water-soluble, right? By forming complexes, these are some of the little tannins that can bind to other molecules. So, you know, those of you who have studied formulation and extraction and solubility and those sorts of things, we'll talk about, you know, don't put a tannin-rich herb in with an alkaloid-rich herb, right, because the tannins can bind to the alkaloids and cause them to fall out of solution, and then you get, like, alkaloid crystals and goop on the bottom of your tincture bottles. So, you know, remember that the OPCs are actually kind of tannin, and they have a pretty weak ability to form complexes compared to the larger tannins, so they're not as much of an issue as, you know, some tannin-rich plants in that respect. And I think I might have mentioned a lot of these properties already, but just to reinforce, OPCs have antioxidant power, they have anti-inflammatory power, they're mild or gentle astringents, they're cardioprotective, okay, Hawthorn, they protect cell membranes, and they protect a lot of different tissues in the body by virtue of, you know, this basic antioxidant free radical scavenging power that they have. Okay, so we mentioned pycnogenol and grapeseed extract. I'm not promoting any particular supplement here. It's just something that a lot of people have heard of. And we find high concentrations of OPCs in red wine along with the anthocyanins. And, you know, those of you who are interested in wine, talk about how, you know, how astringent or how tannic or how oaky a wine is. This is what, these are the molecules that we're talking about. You find them in grape skins and seeds, elderberries, blueberries, cranberries. Companion molecules, as I said, to the anthocyanins. Hawthorn is rich in them. That's what our illustration is here. We have hawthorn flowers, hawthorn leaves, hawthorn berries, and here's an actual photograph of the berries. You know, and there's a lot of variety in different kinds of hawthorn. You get berries that look differently. The highest concentration of OPCs is actually found in the buds of the hawthorn flowers. Since they studied this a lot out at the Gaia Herb Farm in North Carolina, so they get a really rich concentration of OPCs out of those flower buds, which is really interesting. You find them in ginkgo and green tea and a lot of other medicinal plants, actually. So that's just sort of the short list there. And again, these are the colorless polyphenols. So you don't see these, but they're the companion molecules of the colorful flavonoids. And what about white? I think we've looked at this whole rainbow of colors, and we looked at black, which is really dark purple, and we looked at some important invisible molecules. And to wrap up, we're going to look at white molecules, okay? So where do you find white in the plant world? Not that many places. Like, we do see some white flowers, and very often white is just the absence of colorful molecules. So it's not a special molecule unto itself necessarily. You know, so when you see, you know, like a white rose compared to a red rose, what you're seeing is, you know, that the phytochemicals in the white rose, they haven't just developed a lot of these colorful carotenoids or anthocyanins or any of that. But another thing that appears white is saturated fats or saturated fatty acids. So when you look at inside some of your tropical fruits, right, you see high concentration of saturated fatty acids. And these are the beneficial saturated fatty acids, right? Because we used to, you know, we used to be like, oh, saturated fat, bad, cholesterol, bad, you know, but as it turns out, that was not only an oversimplification, but in some cases a misperception, right? So, but a high-quality saturated fat, you know, in the right proportions is actually absolutely required for proper function of neural tissue and fetal development and all, you know, cardiac health and, you know, weight maintenance and all of that kind of stuff. So, you know, the right amount of healthy saturated fats is really important. So anyway, when we look at the tropical fruits, like these are palms, you know, so this is palm seed and palm kernel oils are rich in saturated fats. I don't really like to use palm oil because it's an environmental disaster because, you know, it's a very destructive process that they use to farm the stuff. So what I favor is the coconut oil. I'm a huge coconut oil fan, you know, and coconut meat and coconut watery stuff, it's all really incredible. You probably know that coconut oil is rich in medium-chain triglycerides, which are a special, you know, they contain a special kind of saturated fatty acids that can be really, really beneficial. Like, the more of those you get in your diet, the less sugar you crave, you know. So this whole thing that we've gone on about, you know, low-fat diet really ends up for all practical purposes being a high carb diet, right? A high sugar diet, because if your body isn't satisfied with those healthy saturated fats, you just really want to try to make up for it by eating more sugar. So sometimes when people are trying to get off of sugar, we try to have them introduce more like healthy fats, like, you know, coconut oil and fish oil, along with your omega-3 type oils, your other plant omega-3 type oils. So this is just kind of a quick rundown of some of your white saturated fatty acids. We have stearic acid featured in cacao butter, in animal fats. We have myristic acid in coconut oil, palm kernel oil in animal fats, lauric acid in coconut oil and palm oil, palmitic acid in coconut oil, cottonseed oil, which I definitely avoid. You find some of that in olive oil and your animal fats, and arachidic, that's not arachidonic, but arachidic acid in peanut and soybean oils, neither of which I'm a huge fan of, but that's another one. But you'll notice for the most part that you do find these in your tropical oils. And what's interesting about that is if you think about, you know, your healthy saturated fats and your healthy omega-3s, they kind of come from different environments, right? So tropical saturated fats, you know, why would you want a lot of saturated fats if you live in the tropics? Is because they don't go rancid very easily, right? And what makes fats go rancid? Sunlight, ultraviolet, heat, you know. So this is a strategy of tropical plants to be, you know, resistant to oxidation with their saturated fats, right? The other case, on the other hand, is where do you get your, you know, from nature, a high concentration of omega-3s? Fish oil, right? And not just fish oil, but cold water fish oil. So we're talking, you know, circumpolar fish, Arctic type fish. That's where you get a high concentration of omega-3s, your highly unsaturated fatty acids, right? And they need to be unsaturated. Well, they don't have the problem that tropical oils have, so they don't need to resist that heat and UV oxidation nearly so much. But they need to stay wiggly. You know, unsaturated fats are loose and wiggly like liquid oils, right? And when you're a fish and you're swimming in really, really cold water, you know, you want loose, wiggly, highly unsaturated fatty acids in your body, right? So, you know, if they're too cold, if you were a coconut, you know, you'd stiffen up and be hard, right? It wouldn't work for a polar fish. So that's why we get those DHA and EPA, the highly unsaturated omega-3s from cold water fish, while we get our healthy saturated fats from tropical or warm weather plants. Okay? Pretty interesting there. So let's see what we have here. Oh, that was just an abbreviated list of the things we just looked at there. All right. And also that's, you know, this is one of the benefits of healthy animal fats, is if you get like organic, free-range, grass-fed meats, you know, or free-range chickens that can go around eating bugs and weeds and dandelion bits and whatever they want to eat out there, you get these healthy saturated fats in a proper balance with your omega-3s, which is really important. So this is another one of the reasons why you want to eat organic and natural and free-range grass-fed critters. Another place where you might see white is the bioflavonoid collection in citrus, which is really interesting. So some of the flavonoids are really colorful, like we said. Some of them are yellow, you know, some of them are purple and red, but also some of them are kind of colorless. And when you find them in the matrix, the white stuff inside the citrus peel there, you see white in nature, right? So these are some dried citrus peels on a beautiful rock in the mountains in California. That white stuff, a lot of you probably know this already, that white stuff inside a citrus peel is an antioxidant powerhouse. It's amazing. These are the things we like take off our oranges and throw away. That could be a big mistake, because if you can get yourself some nice organic citrus, you know, and you're like, ew, eating orange peels, way too flavorful for me. What you can actually do is scrape that white stuff off the inside of the orange peel. You can do it with a knife. You can do it with your teeth. If you want to, you can eat the whole orange peel if it's organic. And you're getting a rich concentration of polysaccharides in there, right, in that cell wall matrix material, that squishy stuff. You're getting a lot of pectin in there, which is a soluble dietary fiber, right, important for, you know, keeping the proper state of your blood lipids. It's important for feeding your probiotic organisms, your friendly flora in your digestive system. It's great stuff to get pectin, the soluble fiber. So you're getting a rich supply of that in that white matrix material, and embedded in that matrix material is a high concentration of bioflavonoids and a high concentration of vitamin C, which is also actually white when you isolate it, along with other beneficial essential oil molecules that are in there. So that's really a powerful health food. So a lot of times when I'm making my fruit smoothie, I'll actually take a small whole organic orange or a blood orange, or sometimes a lemon if it's summertime, and I'll just throw it right in the Vitamix and blend the whole thing, the white inner peel and the orange outer peel and the juice, and just put it all in there together. And it's actually really, really delicious. So that's another collection of white phytochemicals there for you. Now what about that other white? You know, everybody's ragging on sugar these days, unfortunately. So white can indicate you're having a refined substance, right? So a lot of times when you isolate and crystallize something or you, quote, purify it, you end up with a white product, right? So what is this about sugar? You know, there's various kinds of sugars, and actual sugar cane juice, you know, when it just is concentrated out of the plant, is not white, right? So you see this kind of lovely tannish golden adobe color in there, and that's indicating the presence of, you know, the molasses hasn't been pulled out of that sugar. So, you know, what we use molasses for, it's really mineral rich, right? It's a great mineral tonic product, if you can get organic, of course. So you're seeing the molasses in there with the sucrose. So even like, you know, natural sugar, you know, whether or not you can handle any of that, isn't white. But chemically purified
sucrose is white, right? So sucrose is table sugar. It's one molecule of glucose bonded to one molecule of fructose, right? So that makes sucrose, and that's white. So we have to watch out for certain white things, and we know that, like, a lot of our pharmaceutical products are white, right, because they're isolated crystallized compounds, and if they're not white, it usually means they colored them with some dyes or something, which is not cool either. But, you know, this definitely isn't a webinar about sugar, but I just wanted to point out that, you know, a lot of your clients, a lot of people you talk to are under the misconception that it's, you know, cholesterol that gives you high cholesterol, or eating saturated fats that gives you high cholesterol. And there's really actually not much of an association between how much cholesterol you eat and how much cholesterol is in your blood. You know, for 95% of people, there's no association there. So it's not about cholesterol. It's not really about saturated fats. It's about trans fats, and it's about sugar. Sugar is what causes the things that we've been blaming on cholesterol, right? A lot of the things. So sugar is really bad for the cardiovascular system. It's inflammatory. It's pro-oxidant. You know, too much leads to metabolic syndrome, disturbs blood sugar balance, blah, blah, blah. So it's just, you know, I'm thinking about these kind of things a lot because at our school, we teach integrated herbalism and nutrition, and we're really big on not trying to stick herbal band-aids on nutritional problems. So we kind of work those nutrition and herbalism. It's really sort of melded into one kind of vitalist therapeutics thing, the way I think of it now. So I just wanted to put a slide here in the end before we start our questions and answers. That we did an 8-class webinar on this topic a while ago. It was really fun, so we got to really go in more depth into, you know, synergy and how that works, and variability of phytochemical content, and some solubility and extraction stuff, and we went into the different classes and categories of phytochemicals. So if you're hungry for more of this webinar kind of learning, you can go to the Sylvan Institute of Botanical Medicine, and it was a live webinar, but of course we recorded it, and you can take the class, you know, at your convenience. And also, if you're really, really fascinated with this kind of stuff, you can go to my website, which I don't actually think I have it. Yes, I do. Yay. I have a couple of websites here. So if you want to order my book, which goes into all of this stuff in more depth, you go to herbalconstituents.com. And you can also buy PowerPoint slide sets there if you'd like to use them for lecturing or giving talks and conferences, and or just to have some beautiful visual study aids. There's all different kinds of, all different versions and topics available there. So you can go to herbalconstituents.com for that. And also, just wanted to mention that I wrote this book for, you know, advanced, intermediate to advanced herbalists and naturopathic physicians as a sort of, you know, really good compilation of these sorts of things in the context, or you might say in the matrix of botanical medicine and herbal medicine. So it's written so that we can understand it and to make it useful for people like us. So you might want to check that out. And if you're interested in our school and the programs that we offer, we've got all different kinds of stuff going on. We're starting new programs. You can go to clinicalherbalism.com to find out more about that. All right, so that wraps up my presentation. I'll be happy to answer questions for the rest of the time we have.
Okay, there were a few questions that got answered. Boy, I enjoyed listening to you, Lisa. You have a great sense of humor, and I love your approach to things, too, so that was fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. There were a lot of times I wanted to, like banter with you a little bit about some of the comments you were making.
How much time do we have left?
Yeah. Anyway, the first question that was asked was, how does metal poisoning, which causes ruin of the senses, affect our ability to identify good foods?
There's a complex question for you.
Yeah, I thought it was a complex question, but it's a good question because I think a lot of people do, because they're exposed to so many chemicals and things, it does kind of dull your senses and your ability to detect things. So
Right. So I guess we're looking at prevention, repair, and workaround.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, as usual, best medicine is prevention. So, you know, learning how to minimize your exposure to those things and also how to support and encourage your body's detoxification systems. Because, you know, a lot of this stuff that comes in, if we're in tip-top shape as far as our, you know, our endogenous detoxification systems, like, you know, most famously the liver enzyme systems, you know, the phase one and phase two detox enzymes that concentrate in the liver. They're not only in the liver, by the way, they're in all the digestive system, mucosa as well, and in the kidneys. So, you know, we know that our liver does a lot of the detoxification for our body, and excretion goes through the kidneys. So if you really support those detox enzyme systems, you can, you know, prevent a lot of the metal toxicity, and you can actually help to wash out a lot of that stuff, even though it's in there. So it's sort of like nature's chelation to support your detox enzyme systems. So what strongly supports those are sulfur vegetables, like brassica family vegetables, your wild mustards, you know, any of your sort of glucosinolate containing things like wasabi, horseradish, you know, watercress, those spicy things that go up your nose. They really rev up those detox enzyme systems. And then turmeric and milk thistle are very, very supportive. Dandelion leaves and flowers are very supportive. So, you know, that's one thing I would do would be, you know, really pay attention to supporting your liver detox enzyme systems to help get some of that out of your body. And then I would say if you're dealing with it, you know, neuroprotective and neuroregenerative approaches would probably be really helpful. So, you know, looking at things like really healthy sources of fats, like your fish oils and, you know, your coconut oil, and neuroprotective supplements might be, you know, indicated. So you might want to think about your acetyl carnitine and your alpha lipoic acid and, you know, high concentrate antioxidant extracts and things like that to sort of help support the regeneration of that nerve tissue to the extent that's possible. You know, we really don't know. And also practicing kind of the workaround, like get all the artificial scents out of your living environment, you know. Oh, by the way, eating a lot of parsley is also really supportive of the detox, right? Cilantro is really famous for it, you know. I think a lot of people explain its powers in the wrong way, but it really is very supportive, cilantro and parsley both, of the detoxification of these metals. And then I think, you know, if you're dealing with this situation, actually just practicing to the extent that you can, you know, if you can smell things, you know, practice on essential oils and, you know, or something that has a really potent, you know, aromatic thing, like really aromatic herbs and flowers, and just practice on things like that, because organoleptics, you really develop it with practice. So, you know, and if you've lost your sense of smell, unfortunately, you know, practice the textures, you know, of things or the colors of things, and you know, you can practice even cultivating your inner ear, so to speak. That's a sort of sense of your intuitive connection with the plant, is another workaround kind of thing you could do in that situation.
Yep. I love shopping with my eyes and my nose and my senses and just smelling, and because you can tell a lot about it. This next question was about ways in which people who live in temperate regions where you don't necessarily have the fresh fruits and vegetables all year round can get more colorful foods in their diet in the winter months.
Mm-hmm. Mm, that's always a challenge. If you can build
didn't
an
say the questions were easy.
Well, you can go for colorful dried stuff, number one. So your culinary spices, think about this. If you get some high-quality turmeric, right, and high-quality paprika, right? So think about or high-quality parsley, or, you know, think of brightly colored, high-quality kitchen spices. That's one way to go for it, right? High quality dried fruits, if they're dried well and they're very colorful, still have a lot of power. So of course, you know, that's what people would do in the old days, like
not that this is necessarily, well, it's not a food, it's a medicinal plant, but people would pick the clusters of the pokeberries in the Appalachians, and they would just, you know, hang them all up in the rafters in their cabins so that they would have those. And actually, pokeberries contain those betalain alkaloids that I was talking about. That's what gives them their color, that kind of intense screaming magenta is kind of what I call that color. And so that's based on betalain alkaloids, which preserves very well with drying. So you can, you know, you can get a lot of your dried things that still maintain their color that way. And then there's the option of frozen berries is a really good one, you know, if you have the capacity to have frozen stuff. So there's a few things you can do with that. You also, you know, a lot of your herbal extractions take out and preserve these things. So you can make like elderberry syrup. That's a great way.
Love elderberry syrup.
Oh my gosh. It's yeah. It's like, yes. pour it on.
Make it for my kids. It was the easiest medicine to get them to take.
Yeah, right?
Just pour it on the pancakes.
And you can squirt other medicines into it. That's what I love it, too. You can use it as a carrier, right? So
yeah.
The way I started making syrups is I make a tincture, and then I make a honey extraction where I actually extract the, you know, the plant material into honey, and then I mix the two of them together, and it's like, oh, my gosh, you get this wonderful broad spectrum of, you know, flavors and constituents, and it's just, you get a great syrup that way. And I started doing that because I make medicinal meads, like MEAD, and I make herbal meads, and, you know, I just started extracting the herbs and the berries right into the honey and found out that worked really well. So then I'm like, well, why don't I just make syrup that way, you know? So you can make syrups out of a lot of your colorful berries and fruits and, you know, flowers and things like that. And that's a good way to get a lot of anthocyanins over the winter.
Great. Here's a very pragmatic question. Where can you get CO2 turmeric?
Just about anywhere. Right, so it's New Chapter makes it. I think they were one of the first ones. When you know where they sell their supplements, I'm not so sure about the turmeric. I know Gaia Herbs is using CO2 extracts in a lot of their products now. So if you look on the bottles, you know, if you go to a place like, I don't know what part of the country y'all live in, but if you have like a Whole Foods or a Vitamin Cottage or a Pharmaca or, you know, whatever your natural foods grocery store is or your herbal apothecary or whatever, you can go there and look at the bottles on the supplements. And, you know, if it has a CO2 extract, it'll brag about it because that stuff's really good and it's kind of expensive. I order mine over the internet. I actually go to vitacosts.com. And because they sell at like big discounts over retail, and I buy a lot of my CO2 extracts there because they're kind of expensive, so you can get a really good deal on them there. Yeah.
Okay. This is a question for me. Someone missed the beginning of the webinar. It is being recorded. It will be up on the AHG website, so you'll be able to see the whole thing. Okay. Back to a question for you. This was also a really interesting question. They asked, when you formulate a tincture, do you visualize the bouquet of colors and think about that in terms of the person that you're looking at, their skin tone and what they're like? Or
I will be doing that. That sounds like a great idea.
It was an interesting thought, you know.
Isn't it?
It is a very interesting thought.
Yeah, I have never actually done that, but you've definitely started an interesting thought process in my head with that one.
Yeah. Any thoughts on chronic inflammation and malnutrition?
Oh my goodness.
Now that's a broad question too.
No, I don't have any thoughts on that. Not a single one. Yeah, my answer to that question is come to school at my school.
I think
we'll
you mentioned
talk about
a few
that
things.
For months so, and
such
months.
Such as not eating the sugar and the white refined foods and eating all these colorful fruits
goodness.
And vegetables with all these antioxidants. I mean,
right?
That's really.
Yeah, you could kind of answer that question with, like, see all previous topics that we just discussed, right? Because, you know, inflammation is an interesting thing. Like, we need a certain amount of it because that's how our immune system works. Like, the right amount of inflammation is critical. It's when you get too much of it and it doesn't calm down, right, and it goes on for too long, it's the basis of a lot of disease processes. So it's like modulating the inflammation. We don't want to kill the inflammation. We don't want to get rid of the inflammation. We want to help it get back to its proper levels, right? So, you know, one thing that I'm really big on, and, you know, we're herbalists and we love herbs, but one thing I'm really huge on is the proper sorts of oils in your body. You know, that's a real, like, fundamental thing about inflammation is having the right oils, which means you want no trans fats, right? You want plenty of omega-3s, and I really tend to favor, you know, high-quality fish oils these days for that with a little bit of plant source thrown in. And, you know, you want to balance your omega-6s with your omega-3s, and you want healthy saturated fats, right, and healthy cholesterol sources. So, you know, like I said earlier, grass-fed, free-range, organic eggs and chickens and beef and those kinds of things. And the oil situation is really important for inflammation, for maintaining the right level of inflammation in your body. And then, you know, you take that a step further and you really minimize or totally remove the refined sugars from your body, because sugar is definitely inflammatory. There's no question about it, scientifically established, you know. And then you go into your dietary approaches with lots of colorful vegetables and dark leafy greens. And you might be supplementing with magnesium, because that's involved in a lot of the systems that regulate inflammation. So, and then, you know, after you've built those layers of the pyramid, then you start in with your anti-inflammatory concentrated herbs like your turmeric, your milk thistle, your anthocyanin concentrates. So that's kind of the overall strategy that we use. And at the same time, you know, you're removing free radical sources from your life, right? Because that they cause excess inflammation. So that means, you know, the smoke is minimized, you know, smoking any kind of plant material, although tobacco is the worst offender by far. And, you know, or, you know, fresh air, however you can freshen the air in your life and remove some of these free radical toxic pollutants from it, you know, getting really strict with organic and, you know, organic foods to keep the pesticides and toxins out of your diet. Yes, they're more expensive, but believe me, they're worth it. And that's my health insurance, you know. Even when I was a broke woods hippie with a baby living in a teepee, I bought organic food. So you can do it too. And, you know, getting, like, everybody talks about stress. It's like, oh, yeah, and then there's stress. Stress is huge, 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 right? So, you know, look at your life and figure out how to start minimizing the various sources of stress, because stress is distinctly and strongly inflammatory. Stress makes you make certain neurochemicals, neurotransmitters, inflammatory modulators, you know, and it shifts the whole neurochemical environment inside your body when you're stressed out. You know, emotional stress, spiritual stress, job stress, trying to work too hard stress, all those kind of modern life stresses make free radicals in your body. They're pro-inflammatory, and they contribute to and they aggravate chronic inflammation. So, you know, sometimes it's not taking the herb, it's taking away the aggravation that's going to have the bigger effect on your health.
I call it detoxifying your life, not just your body.
Right on.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all right. A title for a book.
Yes. Avoid as much of that stuff as you can.
Right.
All right. Another question. Can you explain the traditional use of pokeberries? Thought you had to be really cautious around poke.
Oh, thank you for asking. Okay. Now this is my favorite medicinal plant. actually, when I was going to college and university in North Carolina,
I was already an herbalist. I had been studying herbalism for about 10 years, and I had been running around in the mountains and, you know, following anybody who knew anything and, like, meeting Native American folks down there and meeting old-timers that lived in the mountains forever and meeting really amazing people like Doug Elliott who knew all this stuff. And that's where I got introduced to the pokeweed plant. So pokeweed is a Native American plant, and, you know, you're walking along through the woods out there, and all of a sudden, you know, there will be a little clearing or something. See this huge pokeweed, you know, just like stout magenta stems, and just gigantic thing with clusters and clusters and clusters of pokeberries hanging on it, right? So I was really strongly attracted to this plant. The traditional things that I'd heard was, you know, people would dry them, and they would swallow one dried pokeberry whole every day, and it would keep away rheumatism, cure arthritis. That's what they said in the mountains. And I got really intrigued by that. I'm like, what's this dried whole, don't chew it, you know, cures arthritis. What's going on with this plant? So when I went to college, I mostly studied chemistry and botany and plant ID and physiology and anatomy and physiology and those kind of things. But every chance I had to do like a project or a thesis or an independent study or research or whatever, I tried to make it be about herbal medicine. So I ended up writing my thesis on pokeweed. You know, and it was really, really fun because I got to go to all these libraries, these old dusty libraries, and like pull out books like starting in the 1700s and the 1800s, and I think I might have read just about everything that's been published on pokeweed, that in English anyway, up to that point. I think that was in 99 or 2000 when I did this. So I really got into it. I started asking all the herbalists and old timers and Cherokee folks that I met out there, and like, what do you do with this? You know, what do you know about it? So I got the sort of traditional herbalist perspective on it, as well as, you know, all of the stuff recorded. And then I read probably like 100-something different scientific studies about it, because there's some powerful stuff in there that's been looked at. So here's the safety thing about pokeberries. Pokeberries have poisonous seeds inside them, right? So it's the seeds that are the most toxic part. Now, the tricky part is, if you've ever opened a pokeberry, you notice there's a lot of really tiny seeds inside, right? And the old botanical name for it used to be Phytolacca dechondra. Deca is 10, right? So deca means 10. So most pokeberries have 10 seeds inside, although I did personal experiments with pokeberries, and some of them, the lowest one was 8 and the highest one was 13, so there is a bit of range. So, but you can expect a lot of little seeds inside there, and traditionally you swallowed the berry whole, like a pill, right? So you didn't chew up the seeds. And there's actually a sad case recorded in a toxicological case history where somebody thought they were getting grapes, wild grapes, but they were actually picking pokeberries, and they picked a whole bunch of them and threw them in a blender and busted open a bunch of the seeds, and they drank it like grape juice, and it actually killed them. Right, so that's an extreme exposure to pokeberry seeds. So if the seeds actually have some really intense toxic proteins and lectins in them, and you really don't want to be chewing them open, but if you swallow them whole, they just pass right through, right? So, but when I was doing my pokeberry eating experiments, I decided to see how many pokeberries can I eat before I feel funny, because I'd heard different kinds of things from different people, right? So I would go and I would sit with a poke plant, and I would pick a berry, and I would squish it in my mouth, and I would sit there, and it's totally a Zen exercise, and spit out every single seed and count it and then write it down. Like, this berry has 11 seeds, you know. And I got up to 25 pokeberries, you know, so I spit out all the seeds, and then I would swallow the skin. And you have to really pay attention, right? And not to let any of those get by. So it was really meditative. So I got up to 25 pokeberries, and at 25, my mouth really started to sting, and my tongue was stinging. And I was like, this sounds like a clear signal, clear biological signal that I shouldn't eat anymore, right?
I'm glad to know somebody else is the kind of who does human guinea pig experiments on themselves besides me.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's a traditional way, you know. So
yeah.
Of course you educate yourself first. You don't do something stupid,
of course,
right?
Of course.
but it's the saponins in there that makes them sting. They're really rich in saponins, which are medicinal chemicals, right? So it's a matter of dose, like everything. You know, dose, the poison, is the toxicity of something, is a matter of dose, right, or dosage. So you always have to think. So we know it's a low-dose botanical.
Yeah. So a couple of people asked if your thesis is published anywhere.
It's not. And in fact, it's in kind of raggedy condition at the moment, unfortunately, because I have not updated it for 12 years. But with those caveats, if anybody really wants it, I actually email it to people. So if you would like to get a copy, and you know, you have to sort of wade through its little raggedy edges a bit, but there's a lot of really good stuff in there, just email me. You know, go to my website, clinicalherbalism.com, go to the contact page, which has my email on it, and send me an email, and I'll send it to you.
Great. Well, yep. we've gone almost an hour and a half, and there were a couple other questions, but I think that you've done a good job, and we're losing people. They're signing off because they're going to bed.
They're like, no, but
we've had a lot of people also express comments, you know, thanking you for the webinar and saying it was great and excellent. They enjoyed your teaching. So
excellent.
I did too. It was fantastic. Thank you, Lisa. You're a great teacher, very entertaining.
Thank you.
I've enjoyed listening to you, and everybody else has as well. So thanks everyone. And again, this webinar has been recorded and will be posted on the AHG website. Thanks everybody, and good night.
Good night all.